Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Flashback 60 years ago to some 100 years after the Civil War, equal rights for black Americans were still being fought for in the 1960s. Many places would not even allow some people to sit down and have a dinner at a restaurant or even drink out of the same water fountain because of the color of their skin. Brave souls like Rosa Parks, Dr. Martin Luther King, and others, including the famous football father of our guest, Maya Washington, battled racial ignorance in their own lives. Maya shares her family stories of over 50 years ago in her book and film that she tells about the powerful tale of courage and a championship football team that defied the odds. And it's all coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of Pigskin Dispatch. Welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have a great episode tonight. We have a special guest. We have Miss Maya Washington, who is an award-winning documentary film that's called Through the Banks of the Red Cedar. And she also is the author of a book of the same name and has the catchphrase, "My father and the team that changed the game," added to that. She's also a fellow podcaster with her Light and Shadow podcast. We're going to get into that a little bit because that's extremely interesting. And she's been on talk shows such as Tamron Hall recently, the Big Ten Network with her film, and PBS for Black History Month in February. So I'd like to welcome Miss Maya Washington to the Pigpen.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me, Darren.
Well, this is quite the pleasure, Maya. Maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and you know, the big mystery to our listeners, who your famous father is.
Well, I think it's kind of fun. I love that you left it as some breadcrumbs. So maybe I'll keep it going a little bit longer. So
sure.
Hints. My last name is Washington. My father wore number 84 throughout his career, and I'm very proud to say he's the original number 84 for the Minnesota Vikings, and my father's name is Gene Washington.
And yeah, Gene Washington. For those that don't remember Gene Washington, we have some of our listeners might be a little bit young to remember him, but man, what a history that Gene Washington and some of the teams that he played on both college and the professional level in the NFL had. And we're going to get a chance to talk about him quite a bit tonight and some of your projects. You have your book and your documentary, which centers on a story of your dad's football career, but really it has some greater accomplishments than what he ever did on the field. And we're very excited to talk about it. So I guess maybe you could start off by telling a little bit about yourself and how you got into this project.
Well, you know, I grew up in Minnesota. My parents chose Minnesota as their home when my dad was drafted in 1967 and never really left. He had a stint with the Denver Broncos, but they remained in Minnesota. And I came up long after my dad's football career had ended. So I didn't know him as the football player. I knew him as a guy who put on a suit and went to work every day in corporate America. And luckily, you know, was really fortunate to be exposed to the arts by both of my parents, and they were very supportive of my being involved in the arts. So while my dad was this amazing athlete, my athleticism found its way into dance dance performances. I had an opportunity with, you know, the Super Bowl was just a couple weekends ago. When I was a kid, I got to dance in the Super Bowl halftime show. Really? So that was pretty much as close to his athletic world or the football world that I had come to pretty much for most of my like.
What Super Bowl did you get to dance in?
That was in 1992. It was in Minneapolis. And so at this point, I'm not even sure what number it what number it was, but it was in 1992 in Minneapolis. I'm pretty sure it was 1992. And Gloria Estefan was the headliner, was the main act, and myself and, you know, other kids and teens from the Twin Cities. This was kind of before the halftime show became what it is now, where they would actually make a huge production and, you know, cast dancers and performers and entertainers, you know, locally for that halftime show. And so I did not necessarily grow up knowing about the football career, but went into dance and acting and theater and became a writer and a filmmaker. And so it was 2011 when, unfortunately, my dad's teammate, Bubba Smith, passed away. Many will know him from the Police Academy movies. That's how I knew of him and thought it was pretty cool that my dad's teammate was a movie star. But he was a very significant figure at Michigan State University and in the NFL, and found out at his memorial service and in the days leading up to it, spending time with my dad and his teammates, that Bubba Smith was the reason my dad got to Michigan State. He made that recommendation to Duffy Doherty, Bubba and his father. And to put that into context, they played against each other in a segregated league. So at the time that my dad was growing up in rural Texas, everything was completely segregated. So separate bathrooms, you can't attend the same school. You can't even walk in the front door of a store. You can't be seated or served in a restaurant. You know, of course, buses, interstate travel, everything that we really take for granted as part of American life now was definitely something that my dad, Bubba Smith, and other Black men and women and people growing up in the South during that time had to contend with. And so for Bubba Smith to make that recommendation for my dad, an opponent from a school 100 miles away from Beaumont, Texas, where the Smiths lived, LaPorte is where my dad grew up. And to know that they did that for my dad and to fully understand what this opportunity to play football at Michigan State, but actually be on a track scholarship. He ran indoor and outdoor track during that time. It all came into focus for me when Bubba had passed, and I didn't have an opportunity at that point to say, whoa, Bubba Smith, you changed my dad's life and inadvertently changed my life and changed so many lives because they were a part of this historic team at Michigan State where Duffy Doherty was actively recruiting Black players from the South at a pace and a rate that no one else had done previously in the United States. So it led to the first fully integrated team in America. And when I say fully integrated, it means that prior to their recruitment year in 1963, you might see one or two African-American players in a program every 100 years since, you know, football began. So to have 23 Black players come in during that 1963 class and for them to go on the way that they did, I said, whoa, how is it that A, I didn't know this story? And B, why don't more people know this story? Because this is so significant. This is so important. And so I proceeded to make a film about it. And that film also led to a book. And that's the sort of exciting place that we're at now, where more people are finally becoming aware of this really cool historical thing that happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's tremendous. Now, we've talked about it on this program before. We've talked about the 1939 UCLA Bruins, where they had three African-American men on them, including Jackie Robinson, the great baseball player, was on that team. And that was, you know, big trend-setting, racial barrier-breaking thing then for those three to be playing. And of course, you know, we're familiar with the movie with Ernie Davis of Syracuse and some of the things, but I think that might have been even after your dad was at Michigan State. But this story, it gets better and better, folks. I mean, as Maya gets into this, but the Michigan State teams that her father was on are truly, just looking at them in the record book, you know, I think they had two national titles in the mid 60s. And what they did after that is just amazing, too. But please continue, because Duffy Doherty and the whole team just did some great things in football history and also in society of American society in breaking some racial barriers. And it's very much appreciated and very interesting. So please continue on that.
Well, you know, I think what also is really amazing, because we have to acknowledge those men who were sometimes the one or one of three, as you mentioned, to sort of carve out a space of opportunity that made it possible for my dad and his teammates on those 65 and 66 national championship teams, or those really incredible athletes, to even be given a shot. And that is really amazing to me. And it was also amazing to learn more about Michigan State University at the time. The president of the university, John A. Hanna, was actually the chairperson for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. So he was appointed to that position and was really instrumental at a key time in American history in making America and the federal government more aware of the challenges that people of color were facing and other groups who were experiencing second-class citizenship. So he brought a lot of that knowledge and that awareness that while the country would be shaping legislation to make sure that civil rights were protected for all people, and that, you know, leading to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, to have your university president, who has a athletic director, Biggie Munn, and then a head coach, Duffy Doherty, all sort of aligning in recognizing that the country was headed in a different direction, and seeing this both as an opportunity to expand their football program, to really put Michigan State University on the map in a way that they maybe hadn't had the opportunity. Of course, Michigan State had gone to the Rose Bowl, had come into prominence after joining the Big Ten Conference, had been recruiting Black players as early as the mid to late 40s. But for this to be that moment to say, we're going to do something no one has done, no one has seen, and to have it all pay off at such a pivotal time in American history is just really, really exciting. And even more amazing that some of these men, many of them, they're still with us. You know, my dad is still alive, you know, and to know that we've come so far in such a short time as a country, but can benefit from looking back and seeing, you know, what it took for all of these parts to come together to actually make change happen, and to see how it benefited so many people.
Yeah, I bet your father's got to be extremely proud knowing the part he played, looking at the landscape in the rosters of college football programs today all over the country. You know, it is, truly integrated. You know, we have folks of all colors and creeds and nationalities playing college football, and all, you know, in harmony. And I've heard it said many times that, you know, a football locker room is sort of, you know, decades ahead of where the rest of the country is. You know, I've heard, you know, players back in the 60s that played in the NFL, you know, saying, you know, they really didn't have racial issues. They were, you know, they were your brothers out there playing, white, black, you know, Asian, Islanders, everybody, you know, that played was your brother out there, and you were all for a common goal. And it's I'm glad that it's starting to grow, every decade and get more and more into society to maybe we'll have that harmony someday that we all hope for.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it is pretty amazing and profound. And really what you pointed out too, though, is that sense of when you're playing on a team, the only colors that matter are the colors of your jersey,
Absolutely.
That you know what team you're on and you know that you have to work together, especially with a sport like football, where Joe Capp said 40 for 60, that, 40 guys, 60 minutes playing as one, that kind of mentality. But I was really taken aback, not shocked, but it sort of stood in really interesting contrast to that kind of mentality, knowing that even at the Minnesota Vikings, they would travel south and some of the Black players be run off from the hotel or receive sort of second class treatment, or that Jim Marshall, one of the greats at the Minnesota Vikings, huge pioneer in the NFL, would receive hate mail from people, having something to say about him being Black and him playing for the Minnesota Vikings. So both were true. Duffy Doherty got pushback. There were teams that they knew they couldn't play, that couldn't be on the schedule. So I think that's really, really telling that football has a way of moving things forward, even when the communities where the game is played may not be ready for that change, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It really illustrated. I've not experienced that, but I can tell you, I mentioned Ernie Davis earlier, and they had the great movie The Express was out a few years ago. And there's some scenes there where Syracuse, a northern team having some players of color on it, they have to go down. I believe they played like at Alabama, and this is like in the mid-60s, probably about the same time frame your dad was playing. And they got down there, and they weren't allowed to stay in the same hotel. And the coach of Syracuse ended up talking him into getting him a room at the hotel, but it wasn't to the level that the white players were staying in. It was just that you could see the resentment in the society of the South that they had, and I'm sure they faced it in other places too in the North, but what brave men that your father and these other gentlemen were to go through that, to play the game of football and to go and play at a high level and to overcome and come out on the other side and be the better people for it and making society a little bit better too. That's quite a testament to them.
Yes. And no, I agree. And it gives me a lot of inspiration and hope, and sort of becomes a North Star of sorts, as I'm, looking at life in 2022. But there's so much that they did, and there's so much that we can learn from what they accomplished.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Now, they won the national title, Michigan State, with your father and Bubba Smith and some other great stars on that team, in 1965 and 1966, I believe. Was it? Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. That's right. 1965 and 1966. And in 1967, my dad and three of his teammates were drafted in the first round, and that has never happened and hasn't happened since then. So, Bubba Smith was number one. Clinton Jones was number two. George Webster was number five. And my dad was number eight overall. So to have four players from the same school within the top eight picks had never happened before, hasn't happened since. And just speaks to sort of how significant that recruitment for them to go to Michigan State to achieve what they'd achieved in their college careers, and for that to sort of be a major historical development leading into their pro careers is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I saw that. I cheated a little bit. I listened to your recent interview you had with Arnie Chapman, who is a partner with me on the Sports History Network. And so I listened to that, and I'm like, going, boy, that's never happened before. I'm thinking, okay, it had to happen recently. I mean, Alabama in the last 10 years has had some tremendous players come out after winning a national championship. So I looked it up, and I've got three examples. The 2017 draft, Alabama had four players go in the top 32 in the first round.
Okay.
But they were 16th, 17th, 19th, and 31st. In 2012, Alabama had Trent Richardson go at number three, Mark Barron at number seven, Drake Kirkpatrick 17th, Dante Hightower was 25th. 2011, their great team they had that year, they were the third spot, sixth spot, 25th and 28th. Michigan State in 1967, 1, 2, 5, and 8, you know, four in the top 10. Wow. That is remarkable. And like you say, why aren't people, you know, shouting this from the mountaintops? This is it's never been even close to being that well before by one draft class, all from the same team in the top 10. Wow. Mm-hmm. Truly some great athletes your father and his teammates were.
Very, very, very cool. Like, it's surreal, you know, it's completely surreal, and then completely surreal to see Alabama dominate in the way that it does. And a lot of those SEC schools now, knowing that my dad could not play those schools, that the opportunity for competition wasn't available on either side because of the prevailing culture at the time. So it is really wild to look at history, to look at, you know, how different things are. And to, I appreciate your sort of going through those other milestones in Alabama, right? For us to really look at how much of a powerhouse Alabama remains today, and how different we see football today.
Yeah, you know, I found another interesting fact about your father, and I'm not sure if you're aware about this, his rookie season in Minnesota. Okay. Now, he averaged as a rookie in a time in football, in the NFL football, where they didn't pass every time. The running was more prevalent. They probably ran the ball, you know, 70% of the time and only passed the ball 30% of the time. It's not like it is today. But your father averaged 29 and a half yards per reception in 1968. And he caught 46 passes there, 821 receiving yards, 9 touchdowns. That's pretty good for a rookie in today's game, where you're playing more games. And by the way, I think they only played 12 or 14 games back then, where we're playing 17 now. I mean, just to put that in perspective, I believe Cooper Kupp only averaged 14 yards per reception this year. And Jamar Chase of Cincinnati Bengals, the rookie, he only averaged like 18 yards per reception. Your dad was 29 and a half yards per reception as a rookie at the highest level of football. That blew my mind. What an athlete he must have been.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. It's so exciting and so cool to be at a place in my life where I can, I don't know if I will ever be able to fully appreciate it, because I am not that athlete. I am not. I have athleticism, but I don't have what my dad, you know, had. And it's just remarkable to know what he achieved and what he accomplished, and just what an amazing athlete he was. And to know that because of that opportunity at Michigan State, he was really able to live out his full potential as an athlete. And that's something that might not have been possible for him otherwise, you know? So it's pretty, pretty cool.
And now I guess we'd be remiss to mention, you said he went there on a track scholarship. Maybe perhaps you could tell us about what he did at track in college, because it's amazing just as well.
Yeah. So he ran indoor and outdoor hurdles. He is an NCAA champion in the high hurdles. He still holds a record in the high hurdles. They retired his event. It's 120-yard high hurdles. And so when things went from yards to meters and events changed, I think it means that solidly, probably forever, you will hold, you know, this, you know, this record. And so for him, track was something he was very passionate about and really enjoyed, because of course you're part of a team, but it's a little bit different in your individual events. So it really gave him a chance to, in many ways, compete against himself. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like to really prove, his ability as a runner, and to do that sort of as an individual, to be his individual best and to sort of have that competition, really come down to, you know, those 120 yards or those 100 yards or that relay. That's very different in football, because in football, you are very much dependent on everyone else. And that sort of perfect alchemy to occur, you know, where everybody's got to be on their assignment and everybody's got to be in the right place at the exact right time. And everything's kind of, you know, timed to go perfectly. And if it doesn't, if one thing is off, you know, that's a game, you know? And so for him in track, I think he really enjoyed, having a little more control, you know, over what happens, as long as he, you know, focuses on the finish line and gets himself there. I think he definitely really, really enjoyed that. He also, in high school played baseball and basketball and, you know, always played basketball when I was growing up, at the YMCA. And sometimes he would play with the teenage boys that my older sisters were in school with. And I think still even played with, some of the guys that I, you know, was growing up with, some of my classmates, and would dominate on that YMCA basketball court. So yeah, he's quite an athlete.
But judging by, I don't know if it's a recent picture that's on the cover of your book of your dad, but he looks like he could probably still play today, and his age. So, and he's about the same age as my father is. And I know my dad wouldn't want to go out there. Your dad's looking pretty good for just keeping himself in shape. I mean, that's awesome.
To be fair, that photograph was maybe taken in about 2012. So about 10 years ago, but he still looks really great. He still works out. And it's pretty awesome. So it inspires me to make sure that I take good care of myself, so that I can, you know, look good in my 70s.
Right. Okay. Now, I mean, so truly a great athlete, and I understand, you know, everything about it. You've got to be extremely proud of being his daughter to do that, but maybe you could explain now the title of your book, Through the Banks of the Red Cedar. Now that's very curious, raises a curiosity to me. Where did the title come from?
So growing up, you know, both my parents went to Michigan State. My parents are from the same small town. And my mom went off to California after high school to pursue her education. And then my dad went to Michigan State. But once they got married, my mom finished her degree at Michigan State. And my dad did his master's degree in the off season. And so they were very much a Spartan couple. And so growing up, we always heard the "On the Banks of the Red Cedar." We always heard the fight song. Of course, I know the full fight song now, but for most of my life, I at least just knew that first line. You know, I did, but I always knew the first line. And so when I started to hear about these stories back in 2011, and thought about, wow, how Michigan State University really changed my dad's life, changed my life, changed the lives of my dad's teammates and their children. It gave me the sense of, you know, through Michigan State, through those small changes, the sport changed, lives changed. And so that's where the title comes from, Through the Banks of the Red Cedar, is where we kind of draw that poetic that poetic line and that appreciation. But for Spartan fans, it comes directly from the fight song.
Okay, I didn't gather. I'm a Pennsylvania guy, so I'm not sure of the Michigan State fight song. So I'm glad you cleared that up. That's extremely interesting how you chose that. Now, I mean, I know you talk a lot about your father, like we just did here the last few minutes. But your book goes into a little bit deeper story, and we've touched a little bit on it, perhaps. But maybe just to give us a little feel for what a reader could expect of picking up the book and reading it, what they could expect to learn from it.
Well, I think, you know, for sure, I encourage people to watch the film because it's awesome to see my dad and his teammates who sat down and did these interviews and really putting a face, you know, to the story. But with the book, what's I think really cool about it is that I was able to expand on the civil rights movement and some of the cultural context and the historical context of what was happening while I'm dissecting these key games that my dad was a part of, but also giving you a glimpse into what family life was like for us and what it was like for me to be Jean Washington's daughter growing up in Minneapolis and how I navigated a race in a very different way and came of age in a completely integrated world, but still had challenges and still had to confront discrimination in different ways and have it surface in different ways. So it, I think, provides a little more background for some of those pioneers who came before my dad, who made it possible for what happened at Michigan State University during Duffy Doherty's tenure possible. You know, so it's really, I think, a little bit of something for everyone. Of course, the football enthusiasts, you get some good meat and potatoes there. But I am also really touched by people who aren't necessarily football experts or even fans, which I know on a show like yours, it's hard to, you know, even suggest that somebody would not be completely in love with the sport of football. But for those people who aren't, there's something there for them as well, you know, and that's pretty exciting. This father-daughter story that people can relate to, either having a father or having perhaps a father figure in their life, or even the possibility that there might have been an absence, you know, of that father figure. I'm really grateful that people are responding to sort of all of the different facets of the book that really, I think, give you a sense of the humanity of the players and the human beings behind the game. When most of the time, when we do get sports history stories, we don't get as far into the humanity. Sometimes we know the stats or we know what happened and kind of those key moments, but to kind of get to know from an emotional perspective, what it was like for my dad and his teammates and what, you know, it was like for my parents, growing up and in that early time in their marriage and those first 2 years, with the Minnesota Vikings and the things that they experienced. So that's, I think, what's in store for readers of the book or people who check out the audiobook. There's a lot there.
Now, I can't even imagine, your father and Bubba Smith and some of the others, you know, coming from the South. Now, your father and Bubba Smith both came from Texas, I believe you said. You know, I've lived up north all my life. I live right on the shores of Lake Erie. It's not as cold as Minnesota is, but I can't imagine going from Texas and going, you know, taking you out of your element as a, you know, 18, 19 year old kid and moving away from your family to go to school. And then, you know, then you have these brutal winters where, you know, probably temperatures they've never seen and some white stuff coming out of the sky. I'm sure that had to be all part of the package of things they had to brave through.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's nothing like winter in the upper Midwest, you know, unless you've endured it. There's nothing that could prepare you for that kind of cold. There's no, You couldn't stand in front of your freezer or a meat locker, you know, to try to prepare it. Like there was no preparation for the cold, for the snow. And I know for my dad, the conditions in the South for him were so dire that, you know, there was nothing that was going to get in the way of him achieving his goal and being successful and pushing through. But my dad's teammate, Ernie Pasteur, told stories of some of the brothers were like, I don't know about this, you know, or they were just like, I can't, you know, I don't know about this. I don't think I'm going to make it. And the other teammates would console them as best they could and say, no, you don't want to do that. You know, you can do it. And they would encourage each other and look out for each other, but everything was a first for them, you know, first time, attending a school with white students, having white professors, white coaches, again, eating in a restaurant, being able to stay in the campus hotel, right? Which is, you know, tradition in college sports, you know, especially football. You spend the night away from the dorm, you know, to get your head in the game. And so there was so much that they had to adjust to. That I think in the grand scheme of things, a little snow, you know, was probably the hardest part, I guess, you know, to do all of this and to perform at the best of their ability in the classroom, on the field, and in every way possible. And to do that in the snow. The funny thing too, is Ernie Pasteur actually got married on campus during a snowstorm. And so there was a story where he was borrowing Bubba Smith's car and Bubba gave him the wrong key. Like that was going to be the car for the day for him and his bride. And Bubba was running late, and then they had to dig the car out of the snow. So then Ernie was late for his own wedding. So it really was a culture and climate shock for them, adjusting in that way.
But they probably wouldn't remember the car ride, getting him to the church on time if something like that didn't happen, though. So
exactly.
The bride probably wasn't too happy at the time, but probably years later, they could probably look back at it and get a chuckle at it like you and I are right now.
Exactly. It's a great, great, among the great stories. Yes.
Well, Maya, I appreciate it. Maybe you could tell folks where exactly can they find your book? And maybe you have some showings of when your film is going to be on that maybe you could share with us too.
Yeah. So the best place to go, you could either go to our website through thebanksoftheredcedar.com, or you can find both the book and the film on Amazon right now. So the book is available on Amazon, Audible, Kindle, you know, all those different versions, or your favorite bookstore. So you could go to your local bookstore and order it. And the film is currently on PBS stations nationwide. So you could contact your local PBS station and request it. Or on Amazon, you could watch it on the PBS Documentaries Amazon Prime channel. So for Prime members, I think there is a little monthly fee to get all of the movies, but they also have options where you can rent it. But if you're looking for the free option, I would contact your local PBS station and tell them you're dying to see this film and ask them if they've already programmed it and when you can catch it. Or request it and ask them to put it on air so that you can see it in your area.
Well, Maya, we really appreciate you coming on here, sharing your story, sharing the story of your father and all the trials and tribulations he did to become such a great football player in both the college ranks and the NFL, and sharing and preserving that history with us today. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. we invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.